Today is the 29th of March, Sunday morning, our last class before the Pesach break.
Did you give me all the papers?
Yes. And we today are continuing what we did last week, which is to go back to the beginning of the Masechet and work forward. Last week we learned highlights of chapter 1, Perek Aleph of Masechet Pesachim, dealing with the Isurim of Bal Yireh and Bal Yematzeh, the prohibition of owning chametz on Pesach. We also talked about the obligation of Tashbitu, of destroying chametz before Pesach, and Bidikat chametz. And this week we're going to the second chapter, highlights of the second chapter. So we will just very quickly go over the first chapter, since not too many people were here last time. And I'm already reading the first Mishnah of the Masechet. All the arba asar bodkim et the hametz leor hanir ner, which means that light unto the 14th. When we say that light here means darkness, it means when the 14th of the month of Nisan begins. In other words, the laila, that's before the day, we check for hametz at the light of a candle. And we really only have to look at one more line of that Mishnah. Kol makom shein machnisin bo chametz ein tzarech bedika. Any place that one doesn't bring chametz doesn't require checking. And we talked about the fact that really most of what people do as far as cleaning the houses for Pesach is halachically unnecessary, because the only requirement is to check for chametz where it's normally brought in. So if your kids normally eat in the bedroom and normally put crumbs in their pockets, that's one thing. But if you have a house without children, with older children, or a house in which the mother prevents people from bringing food into the bedroom, then there's no need before Pesach to check for chametz any place, but in the kitchen or in the dining room, and that's all. And I mentioned that Rav Shlomo Aviner, one of the foremost poskim in Israel today, every year gets on the radio and says, don't clean your houses for Pesach. Don't do it, because it ends up being counterproductive. When women get to the Seder, so exhausted, sometimes exhausted physically, but sometimes exhausted mentally, it's just not worth it. And it actually ruins the experience of the Seder and the experience of freedom.
Or the arguments.
When they force you to clean the house, right? So it's just kol makom shemachnisin bo chametz ein tzarech bedika. No requirement to check for chametz except where you normally bring chametz. The second Mishnah said, it's the first page still, the second Mishnah, the bet for the second Mishnah is in the left-hand column.
Excuse me, do you have another copy of the Mishnah?
Yes. Ein choshashim shema garara chuda mibayit lebayit umimakom lemakom. We don't fear lest a rat dragged chametz from place to place. In other words, if you checked your house for chametz on the night of the 14th, and you know that your friend didn't check, you don't have to be afraid that lest his rats took his chametz to your house after you checked it, which would mean you'd have to check it again. No, you checked it once and that's enough.
Okay.
Let's go on to the next Mishnah. We'll just read the very end of Mishnah Gimel, the very end, the last eight words. Umashem mishayer yanichenu v'tzina kedei shelo yehei tzorich b'dika acharav, which means that which you leave, mishayer, leave, yanichenu v'tzina, you should leave it in hiding, in order that there won't be a need of checking after it. In other words, when you check the chametz on the 14th of the night, what you leave over in order to eat the next day, leave it in a clear, hidden place, and don't just leave it on the table, because if you do, then it might get scattered, and then tomorrow you have to check again. Which goes to show you that if you do things right, you don't have to check again. You check once on the 14th of the month at night, and that's it. That's it. And by the way, it has to be clear, like we said last time, checking on the 14th at night, that's their cleaning for Pesach. It's not a ritual checking. That's when you check to make sure there's no chametz in the house. It takes half an hour, it takes an hour. An hour a day, it might take 3 hours to check all the cans and all the goods in the kitchen. But that's all. That's all. There's no need to do anything before that.
I'm glad to see this because there's been times where I've learned things, you know, seen in Leviticus, you know, where I've thought that there's a compulsiveness in Torah. But this is teaching me that it's not the case.
Or at least not here.
At least not here.
Is it unnecessary to, like, the Kabbalistic thing where you set out 10 pieces of bread?
Well, the Mishnah didn't know about that. Right? That comes much later. It's the custom to do it today, so we do it, and that's fine.
But there's a custom, but halachically, you don't need to.
It's written in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Ramah, that that's our custom. That's our custom.
The autonomic custom is to set
it. Is to do it, so we do it. That's a nice custom.
But the point is that you shouldn't spend too much time searching.
But the point is that you shouldn't spend time cleaning your house for chametz in places that chametz is not likely to be found. And if you, let's see, if you live in a small apartment and you just moved into it a month ago, you should be able to do all the cleaning for Pesach within 2 hours.
Yeah.
Of course, we have to add to that today. Since we have a lot of dishes, we also have to kasher our dishes. I'm not talking about that.
Right.
That might take another 2 hours.
Yeah.
Right.
And then if you're selling food, you have to put it away.
Right. The Mishnah doesn't know about that.
Right.
And of course, if you're cooking for the Seder, you might have a need to have the house ready before the 14th at night. So there's all different types of little complications, or big complications. But the principle is that you don't have to spend time cleaning your house for spring cleaning.
And also, like, I learned this in school, and also, like, crumbs are ownerless.
Mm-hmm. Right, as long as they're not the size you'd pick up off the floor and eat, then the crumbs are ready, as far as you're concerned, not chametz that you own.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The fourth Mishnah, Mishnah Dalit, which was the last Mishnah we did last time, and it says, Rabbi Meir Omer, Uchlin kol chamesh, v'sorfin b'tchilat shesh. Rabbi Yehud Omer, Uchlin kol arba, v'tolin kol chamesh, v'sorfin b'tchilat shesh. This is about what we do on the morning of the 14th, not the night before, but actually the morning of the 14th of Nisan, 10 or so hours, or 7 or so hours before the Seder. And there's a machloket. Rabbi Meir says, I'm going back to the beginning of the Mishnah to translate. Rabbi Meir says, we eat all five. And it's referring to the hours, the halachic hours of the morning. In other words, we can eat chametz for the whole first 5 hours of the morning. We know halachic hours from the time the sun goes up, from the time it goes down, divided into 12 equal parts. Until the end of the fifth hour, we can eat chametz. V'sorfin b'tchilat shesh, and we burn the chametz at the beginning of the sixth hour. The beginning of the sixth hour is chatzot. As we saw last time, the reason we have to burn the chametz by chatzot is because the verse in the book of Exodus says, "Lo tizbach al chametz dam zivchi." You shouldn't sacrifice the korban Pesach while you still have chametz in the house. The Korban Pesach has to be sacrificed on the 14th, Bein Ha'arbaim, which means the afternoon, which means the earliest time to sacrifice the Korban Pesach is Chatzot, is noon, and therefore by noon you should not have any chametz left. So according to Rabbi Meir, you can eat chametz until the last minute that you have to burn. It has to be burnt by the beginning of the sixth hour, which means you're allowed to eat it to the end of the fifth hour. Now understand, the end of the fifth hour and the beginning of the sixth are separated by half a millisecond. Right? The end of the fifth hour is the beginning of the sixth, with 1 millisecond distinguishing between them. So according to Rabbi Meir, there's absolutely no fences. Talk about neuroses. There's no fences in a place we'd expect one to be.
Right.
You can eat chametz until the second before you have to burn it. I'm not suggesting to do that.
No, we don't hold that way, halacha l'maaseh.
And we don't hold like that. Right. But according to Rabbi Meir, that's the halacha. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda says, Ochlin kol arba. We can only eat chametz the first 4 hours. to the end of the fourth hour. But the fifth hour...
Or about 10 o'clock or something in the morning.
Usually comes at the 10. But the fifth hour, we cannot eat chametz. Tolin kol chametz. We hang it. Literally means it's hang in abeyance. It can't be eaten, but you don't have to burn it yet. V'sorfin b'tchilat sheish. And we have to burn it by the beginning of the sixth hour. So Rabbi Yehuda doesn't make any gzerah, any rabbinic fence as far as the burning. You could wait to burn it until the very last second. It has to be burnt by the beginning of the sixth hour, and you can wait until that second to burn it. But you can't wait that late to keep eating it. Eating it, you have to wait. You have to push it up an hour, so there's a period of limbo, period of abeyance. The chametz has to be eaten, and it can't be eaten after the end of the fourth hour, but you're allowed to wait to the last minute, an hour later, to burn it if you really want to live dangerously.
Does anyone talk about Baal Tashchit and burning?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
The concept of
but what?
Away food, Baal Tashchit.
But it seems to me a no-brainer that it's certainly
can you
better.
Just remind us what that means.
A no-brainer is...
Oh, Baal Tashchit.
Kidding.
I fell for that one, didn't I?
Well, since you always teach me English, I...
What, it seems like a no-brainer, you're saying that
you should make an effort to finish your chametz before Pesach so that you don't have to end up destroying it. Baal Tashchit is the prohibition against destroying, including throwing away food. Some. Yeah. Except that, as we're about to see today, Rabbi Yehuda holds the only way to fulfill the mitzvah of tashbitu, of destroying chametz, is by burning it. I'll explain. There are two sides to the coin here. As we saw last time, there's the prohibition of bal yira'eh v'bal yimatzeh. Don't see it and don't find it. Which basically means you can't own chametz on Pesach. That's what it basically means. Which means, of course, you have to, in order not to own it, you have to not buy it to begin with. But since most of us have bought or made chametz beforehand, we have to get rid of it. How do you get rid of it? By eating it or by selling it. By selling it, I mean completely and absolutely selling it so you'll never see again.
Which is a late development, right?
I said completely and absolutely selling it so you'll never see it again. That's been existence since human beings have been on the earth, that they've sold and bought things, right?
Okay.
So you either have to eat it or you have to sell it or you have to destroy it.
You're not including abandoning or throwing.
Okay, even abandoning it. Whatever.
Okay.
You have to do something in order not to own it on Pesach.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, the other side of the coin is that in addition to the negative that you can't own on Pesach, there's also a positive mitzvah to destroy it before Pesach. So by selling it, let's say, or abandoning it, you're preventing yourself from transgressing the negative commandment of Pesach Avoniyat, but you're not fulfilling the positive of destroying it. So therefore, there's a place to say that most of your chametz before Pesach, you should just try to,
finish,
sell or abandon.
Or consume.
Wait a second. But at least a small portion you should leave in order to burn, in order to fill the mitzvah of Tashbitu. Because Rabbi Yehuda holds that the only way to fulfill the mitzvah of Tashbitu, to destroy it, is to burn it. That consuming it doesn't help. Again, if you consume it, you won't be transgressing the negative of owning it on Pesach, but you won't be fulfilling the positive of destroying it. So there is a place to leave some chametz available, as we do in our custom today, with the 10 pieces, that we do burn on the morning of the 14th in order to fulfill the positive mitzvah of Tashbitu. Tashbitu.
If done correctly, shouldn't take much time.
If it done correctly, since there shouldn't be that much, you mean?
I mean, like, in terms of, like, get all the qualms, like, it just shouldn't be prolonged. It should just, like, get it over with.
The prolonged checking, you mean, and cleaning?
I mean, just, like, don't be, like, very compulsive.
Yeah, but you should be compulsive about the burning. I've seen so many cases in my life, every year I've seen this, people throw chametz into the fire and walk away, and it becomes very toasty toast, but it's not destroyed. To destroy chametz in a fire takes effort. You have to poke around the fire, and you have to make sure it's all burnt, and you have to cover. Also, I mean, like, we did that once.
We did it together a few years in a row.
Oh, you have to work hard to burn tomatoes.
In my home in Europe, we used to have an oven, and just every shul, a big oven burning. Yeah. And everybody brought the hummus to that oven, put it in there, and burned it there.
So in the oven, I'm sure it was burnt like it's supposed to be.
And there
burnt.
Was a guy who took care of the fire, watched it, that it burns to the end.
That would have been me.
We have in this show, right, fires.
Say it again, please.
Oh, we don't?
We no longer do it.
Oh, we don't do it in the show.
Yeah, so go to Paul's backyard. It seems to me, it seems to me that holding
fire
some,
risk.
Yeah.
Holding some food in reserve, you know, I mean, because we could have been told to just sell it all and then eat salad for a while and then start eating matzah, you know, at Pesach, or you know, and then also, you know, these you know, the close time, you know, that you go from one to the other and without the fence, seems to me that it's creating the moment of change is that's more distinct than a, you know, phase into the week, you know, so that you're and that gives the week more distinction, you know, and the cessation of eating chametz is more you know, so related to, with, you know, to the beginning of Pesach.
So this matter of creating the distinction actually is represented in halakha. In the halakha, that you're not allowed to eat matzah for the day before the seder, in order to make the distinction. There are those who have the custom of not eating matzah even from Rosh Chodesh, Nisan, in order again to make the distinction.
So there's no blurring either direction.
Right. Very good.
This word tashbik too. It means.
Well, you can hear in the word tashbitu the language of Shabbat, in other words, to end. Put an end to, a stop. Tashbitu means stop the chametz, or destroy the chametz. Lashbit. Lashbit.
That word isn't in the Mishnah.
That word is not in the Mishnah.
The word here is shorfin.
Where are you? Shorfin, right.
Shorfin. Does that mean burn?
That means burn.
Okay.
Means burn. The word tashbitu comes from the verse in the Torah that says, Hashbitu sur mi batechem. You should destroy chametz from your houses. Okay, so now we are going to Perek Bet. We're learning Perek Bet in the first three Mishnayot, together with the one sheet of instructions and the back of it, which is sources. Right? I've been attacked by a piece of paper. So it says, at the beginning of Perek Sheni, Kol Sha'a Shemutar Lechol Ma'achil. Perek Sheni. Kol Sha'a Shemutar Lechol Ma'achil LaBehima. You have the place?
Yeah. I was getting clear on the Perek Bet, and then Perek Sheni.
Right, same thing.
It's the same. Shani the second.
Yes.
Depends which part of Poland you're from.
Kol shamutar lechol ma'achil labeima lechaya ulaofot mochro lenochri umutar bahana'ato avar zmano asur bahana'ato velo yasik bo tanur v'chiraim. Rabbi Yehud omer ein biur hametz ela shreifa v'hamim omrim af mifarer b'zorer laruach O Matil Layam. Going back to translate. Kol Shah, every hour, Shemutar Lechol, that it's permitted to eat, comma, Machil Lebema, you can feed it to your domesticated animal. Lechaya, to wild animals. Velofot, and to fowl. Umochol Nochri, and you can sell it to a non-Jew. Umutar Bahanato, and it's permitted to get enjoyment from it, to get benefit from it. So to repeat that, it says, as long as you're allowed to eat it, you're also allowed to
feed it
to your animals, to the wild animals, to the fowl, and you're also allowed at the same time to sell it, and you're allowed also to get any type of benefit from it.
as long as you're allowed still to eat it, you can do all these other things as well with it. Avaz mano, past its time, which means the time for eating chametz has passed, then asur bahanato, it's forbidden to get benefit from it.
To get benefit,
to enjoy it.
That would be the fourth hour, right?
It depends which opinion we're going by, right? Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda, as we learned 2 minutes ago. Rabbi Meir says that you're allowed to eat it until the end of the fifth hour. Rabbi Yehuda says you can only eat until the end of the
fourth hour.
And going back to the third line now of the Mishnah, V'lo yasikvo tenor v'kirayim, and you cannot use it as kindling. There must be a better word in English. You can't fuel with it the oven and the stove. Which means, again, as long as it's now forbidden to eat it, you can't get any enjoyment from it, and you can't even use it to fuel your stove and your oven.
What about feeding the behemoths and the chayes and the oif?
It's implied by benefit.
Right.
You're not permitted to...
Sam says you can't, and he's right.
If you have a dog, you cannot feed him anymore?
Right. Can't feed the dog chametz. You have to get him kosher for Pesach dog food.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Or give away your dog.
Or give away your dog.
Yeah.
I would think today that would be pshita because you already kashered the oven. Right? That's another example.
Rabbi Yehuda Omer, middle of the third line, Ein biur chametz el esrefa. There's no eradication of chametz except through sreifa.
You can't sell it even.
Not that you can't sell it. You can sell it, and that will make sure that you're not transgressing owning it.
Right.
Yeah.
But you won't fulfill the mitzvah of biur, of eradicating it, which I called earlier the mitzvah of
tashbitu.
Uh-huh. You can't fulfill the mitzvah of tashbitu, of biur, except through Sreifa. V'chamim omrim, whereas the sages say, af mifarer v'zorel l'ruach o matir l'yam. But the sages say, even crumble it and throw it to the wind, or place it in the sea. Either of those two, according to Achamim, and I assume they're only examples of any way that you have it no longer in your possession. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes.
And it's compost, it's returning it to cycle of nature.
As long as it's not your compost host, it's your neighbor's.
As long as you're not benefiting.
Is this somewhat unusual? Because I thought we usually hold like the Chachamim when there's a dispute between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim. And here it seems like we're holding like Rabbi Yehuda. Or are we just being stringent?
Right, I actually am not sure. I'm sorry that I didn't check it, but my impression is the halacha is not Rabbi Yehuda. We burn it to fill his
stringency.
His stringency, but I'm not sure the halacha is like Rabbi Yehuda.
Okay.
But I'm really not sure.
Okay.
So let's go back to the Mishnah with the questions that I gave. The first two questions we already did, as well as the third. But now we get to the fourth question, which is as follows. Of the three things that are permitted, kol sha'ah shemutar lechol, of the three things that are permitted all the while that it's allowed to eat it, which would seem to be the general category under which the other two should be subsumed?
What are the three? Benefit. Oh, sorry.
What?
Name the three.
I can't hear, Sam. We're talking about chametz, but of the three categories of ma'achil, o mochro, o mutar bahana, like David said, that the last of the three is really the general category under which the other two can be consumed.
Yeah.
If the Mishnah had said that all the while that you're allowed to eat it, you're allowed to get benefit, well then I would know that I could also sell it, selling as a type of benefit, and I could also feed it to animals, whether wild or domesticated.
Right.
So given that there are three categories of permission here, and two are subsets of one, we ask ourselves the natural question, well, why are the two subsets written? Behold, I would know them anyway, just through the general category. It could have just said, mutar bahanato, finished, period. So we want to understand why, if it had written just mutar bahana'a, why might I have thought that it's forbidden to feed it to the animals and forbidden to sell it, so that the Mishnah has to tell me, no, those things are also permitted.
Why didn't it just say to benefit? It's permitted, yeah, to benefit. Why did it have to go out of its way to say...
Right, that's the question I'm asking, exactly. That's the question we have against the Mishnah, and we'll have to look for an answer to that. So let's think for a second, which is my next question. What reasons can you think of that might explain why the other two things are nevertheless mentioned?
Is it money?
Money, what do you mean?
With domesticated and wild animals, you feed the chametz. With the nandri, you can give as a gift. But with benefiting, you can sell it and derive benefit by receiving the money.
Right.
So the Mishnah had to go out of its way to list the other categories, because the money is not covered. The other categories are not under the category of the money.
I'm not following.
Okay,
can I say, are you saying the natural... I'm sorry, I have a different thought. I thought it was similar to what you were saying, but it was really different.
Doesn't the Mishnah go out of its way to say, domesticated animals, wild animals?
And why?
Because benefiting is only talking about money.
Why do you think that, though? That's...
Maybe I didn't understand.
I'm a little confused myself. Could you rephrase? Because without using the Hebrew, if you could.
Okay. The Mishnah says that as long as I'm allowed to eat it, I'm allowed to benefit from it.
Yes.
And also says as long as I'm allowed to eat it, I'm allowed to feed it to animals or to sell it.
Yes.
And the question I'm asking is, behold, if it had only said...
I could benefit.
I could benefit. I would know automatically that I could feed it to my animals and that I can sell it. So why does the Mishnah have to waste words and tell me that I can also do these other things, seeing that they are subsumed under the general concept of hana'a, benefit?
I wonder if it's...
I think chaya is not a domestic animal.
It's a wild animal.
A behemoth. So chaya is a wild animal, yeah.
This is mainly addressing food.
Yeah.
And the normal circumstance is, I've bought food for a specific purpose to eat it. That's the normal, natural benefit I get from food. And so if I said I cannot benefit from it, you may have thought it meant just means in the normal, natural way. And that's eating. But in addition, you can't even sell it to get rid of it that way. You're not allowed to sell it, because that's a broader kind of... idea.
It's true in other contexts that the Gemara talks about hana'a darko and not darko, and it's normal and not normal fashion. But in this case, I don't really see how...
Okay. When it says that you can sell it, the language again says you can sell it to a non-Jew?
Yeah.
It specifies non-Jew?
Yes.
Okay. I think that the reason it's giving this is to... limit the scope of the benefit. I mean, because there are other ways you could benefit.
No. Oh, I see. You're saying...
There are other ways. Okay, if you just had the general, that you could benefit from it while you can eat it, there are things that you could do with it that we want to eliminate. You can't sell it to a Jew. You can't give it to a non-Jew. You can't just dump it in the ground.
Okay, but if you were right... then it wouldn't have listed the general category at all. It would only have given these two specific ways of...
Well, I think that it's... okay.
Most probably.
But feeding and selling two different things?
Isn't feeding it to animals and selling it two different things? It's two different things, but they are both subcategories of the larger category of hana'a.
Isn't hana'a eating?
No. No, eating is eating. Right? Eating is eating. Eating is the word that you can eat it.
Actually, it's clear that my idea is wrong, because it's be like saying, as long as you can eat it, you can eat it. If benefit just means eat it.
Right.
So that's a tautology.
Yeah. So
it couldn't be the benefit means just eat it.
Does anyone have any other suggestions? why the Mishnah has these seemingly superfluous words, and if not, we'll go on and we'll see what the Gemara says in answer to those questions. Well, you know what? Since we have them on the table now, let's see the Gemara right now.
Okay.
Why don't we see the Gemara right now? The Gemara says at the top of the back of the piece of paper, can you show Mr. Gala the place?
Yeah, the back of it.
Oh, here, yeah, on this side, yeah.
This is Masechet Pesachim Daf Chaf Aleph Amud Aleph on our Mishnah, and it says as follows, Kol Sha'ash Mutar Lechol Ma'achil. That's a quote from the Mishnah. All the hour, all the while, that it is permitted to eat, Ma'achil. You can feed it. Three dots. The Mishnah. Says the Gemara, Ha, kol sha'a sheino mutar lachil. I'm sorry, that's not the one I wanted to do. I apologize. Next piece of Gemara. It's on the same page of Gemara. I just skipped, in my quoting of it, I skipped a good 10 or 15 lines there. That's where the three dots are there. Lama li lemitna behema? Lama li lemitna haya? Why to me to write, quote, behema, domestic animal? Why to me to write, quote, haya?
To write.
To write in the Mishnah, to learn in the Mishnah.
Why these words?
Lemitna from the language of matnit, language of Tana, language of to learn in a Mishnah. In other words, why do we have to write Beima? Why do we have to write Chaya? Says the Gemara, De'i Tana Beima, De'i Mishaira Hazila. If we had written Beima, that if it leaves, we see it. In other words, a behema sometimes leaves its food over.
Right.
But we see what's left. Aval chaya, but a wild animal, di mishaira kamatsnila emalo, but a wild animal, that if it leaves over, it hides it, kamatsnila, it hides it, emalo, I think not. So you learn from this two things. You learn from this that you might have thought you're allowed to get hana'a, but you can't feed it to your animal. Why not? Because your animal might leave it over. They're doing it hana'a in a fashion that there won't be any left. You don't want it lying around the barn for when it becomes forbidden. So you might think you can't feed it to your animals. And even if you can feed it to your animals, you might think you can feed it to your animals, but not to wild animals. Because wild animals, they don't leave it over. They go and hide it.
Right. And you could still have ownership?
Good question. It's only a havamina. In other words, this is what I would have thought.
Yeah.
But Sam's saying, what kind of havamina that is that? If the wild animal hides it, well, it's not my problem. What if he hides it on my property? Right? So it's not so simple. So that's why, even though we're not allowed to, we're allowed to get hana'a, you might have thought, hava amina, you might have thought that you can't feed it to your domesticated animal because they'll leave it over and you'll get in hot water looking for it. Kamashma, it comes to teach us, you're allowed to feed it to your animals despite the risk.
Mm-hmm.
But then you might have thought that you can't feed it to your squirrels because they will go and hide on your property and then you're really in hot water. Kamashmala, and it comes to teach you, you can even feed it to the squirrels. Even to your squirrels.
No, I didn't realize I owned the squirrels on my property. Your squirrels.
Okay, it doesn't say your squirrels, I take
it back.
I wasn't being exact.
And I didn't realize they had llamas there. I thought that those were just in Peru.
No,
they have them in the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea and Engedi, they have.
Really?
Yeah, Sam,
I don't think they'd have topic,
but don't.
It's really, like, it's on topic. It said, the Gemara says that it's prohibited to own chomet or on Pesach, and it's prohibited to have it in your hand.
Yes.
So
it's forbidden to own it.
But there's also, like, there's even a leniency. Like, you can't, you can, but non, I'm, what I'm trying to say is that if chomet is not in your hand, it's not a problem.
No, no, you said two different things. You can't have it in your hand, and you can't own it. If I have it in my closet,
but it's accessible to you,
and it's accessible to me, then I'm forbidden. So again, what if not my squirrel, but what if the squirrels take it and hide it under my doorpost, under my doorstep?
So it can't work.
Again, there is something that's called bitul, that you're allowed to nullify your hametz even when it's on your property, and saying that for me it doesn't exist, it's not mine. But we're not going into what is probably a later level of legal thought. Okay. And the whole matter of bitul is actually very problematic halachically, because if there's such a thing as bitul, why do you have to check for hametz at all? Just say to myself, it's not mine, finished. So it's really, that gets into a complicated area. Anyway, says the Gemara has now taught us why we have to mention Beima and Chaya, that they're also allowed to teach. And it said, why do we have to add Chaya over and above Beima? Because then Chaya might hide it. That's why you have to say even that's mutar. But then the Gemara has the opposite question. So then switch the order. Just say Chaya is allowed and don't say Beima. And then you'd say if Chaya you're allowed, even though they might hide it, then all the more so is Beima allowed to have it fed to them. So why don't we just switch the order and leave out Beima? It says in the fifth word of the second line, Vi Tana Chaya, and had we written Chaya, Mishum Mishaira Mihat Mitzna, because when it leaves, nevertheless it hides. Aval Beima Zimnin de Meshaira Velo Masik Adate, but Beima Zimnin, sometimes it leaves Velo Masik Adate, and we don't notice. In other words, it's now agreeing with Sam. Now it's saying, if it had only said Chaya you're allowed to feed it to, you would say, okay, I'm allowed to feed it to the Chaya, because when he leaves it over, he hides it. And that's not my problem. But an animal, when he leaves it over, the animal, when it leaves over, doesn't hide it, and it's right in the open, and sometimes I might not notice, because I'm so busy with other things. I fed it to my animals, I think I'm finished with it. So that's why you have to say Beima, even after you said Chaya. In other words, in the end, you have to say, you need both. You have to say Hana'a is allowed, and you also have to say feeding to Beima is allowed, and you have to say feeding to the Chaya is allowed.
Hana'a? Did we really get to the Hana'a being allowed?
We just didn't mention it.
Right, okay.
But I'm adding that to make life simpler, since we're not learning pages of Gemara for days and days. We're in the beginning of the last line. We did enough. That's enough. Okay. But now we have another question, which we mentioned, which is, if you said that Hana'a is allowed, why do you have to say that selling it to the non-Jew is allowed? That's Shita, right? Because that's a subcategory of Hana'a. So that's also found here in the Gemara. Let me just think which Gemara it's in. Yeah. It's the one right after where we were learning.
Yeah, Shita.
It says, "Umuchrul nochri." It's a dibor matchil from the Mishnah. You can sell it to the nochri, to the non-Jew. By the way, I want to stop for a second, and I should have said this earlier. I'm going to take 2 minutes to stroke my pet peeve, which is that word nochri in the Mishnah. Right, "Umuchrul nochri." Mm-hmm. Notice how I'm pronouncing it. Nochri.
Right, not Nachri.
And you look, right, you look at the text, it seems to say Nachri.
That's the same as Kodshacha. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And the reason I'm doing that is because in the Sephardi pronunciation, which is the pronunciation in Israel today, a kamatz, that's the vowel we have under the nun, is usually pronounced a, the same as a patach. Fach is just a straight line.
Right.
Ah. But there's about 5 or 8% of the cases in which the kamatz is pronounced differently. It's pronounced as an O sound. And there are grammatical rules that tell us which is the regular kamatz of ah, and which is the kamatz katan. It's called the kamatz katan. Kamatz katan, which is pronounced O. And the rule is that a closed, unaccented syllable that has a kamatz in it, it's a kamatz katan. A closed syllable means ending with a consonant. And unaccented means unaccented.
It's nochri and not nochri.
Right.
Right, okay.
Usually 90% of the cases in Hebrew words, the accent's that's on the last syllable, right. Which means any other syllable is unaccented. In our case, the syllable is nun kamatz chaf. So the syllable ends with a consonant. Secondly, it is unaccented. And the rule is, any syllable having a kamatz in it, which is closed and unaccented, is pronounced as a kamatz katan. It's a different grammatical vowel. It just looks the same in the way we write it. But it's a different vowel completely. It's a different name and it's different characteristics. It's a kamatz katan and it's pronounced as an O. It's nukhri. And if anyone says nachri, excuse me, they're wrong.
But in Ashkenazic Hebrew, it's pronounced nukhri.
Right, in Ashkenazi Hebrew, you never pronounce a kamatz as an A. It's always an O.
Yeah.
Which means that whether you're an Ashkenazi or a Sephardi, there's no such thing as a nachri.
Right. Just the stress is different.
Right.
Yeah. What's the stress on the...
How do you say it?
How do you say the word? Nochri.
Nochri.
There are five or six or seven other common words that have this issue. One is a word that Eric just hinted to a few minutes ago that sometimes appears in davening, which is the word like kod shecha. Kod Shecha is written with a kamatz katan, and many, many people, and I hope I'm not embarrassing anyone around the room, but I probably am,
say
Kad Shecha in the Kaddish. It's just wrong. It's wrong for Ashkenazim, it's wrong for Sephardim, because if you're Ashkenazi, you'll be saying Oi in all your kamatzim, and if you're a Sephardi, then you're saying for 95% of the kamatzim Ah, but for the 5 or 6 or 7 or 8% that's kamatz katan, it is Oh, so it's Kod Shecha, Divrei Kod Shecha, or Kodesh Kodeshim. It's almost never Kodesh Kadeshim. There are certain cases where it is Kodesh Kadeshim. By the way, Evan Smith knows.
Right.
He almost never makes a mistake in that.
No,
another common word is the word Orla. The word Orla, if you say Orla, it's wrong. Orla. It's a kamatz, but it's pronounced Orla. Orla. What are the other common words?
There's one in Parshas Yitro that I read and he said something.
Which is it?
I don't know. I think it's Nochri.
Could be Nochri. The word V'yarots, biblically V'yarots, some people pronounce it V'yarats, right? Because it's a kamatz. But in that case, the accent is on the earlier syllable and it's a closed unaccented syllable, the words v'yarots likrato, like Abraham v'yarots likrato, where does that appear? Someplace in Sefer Bereshit, in the Parshiyot of Avraham Yitzchak, he ran. So anyway, the Rinat Yisrael Sidur actually use a different notation to indicate the kamatz katan. They make the stem of it longer so that everyone knows. And even the art scroll does have a system for pointing them out, but no one knows the system.
Right.
Their system is, to make a long story short, that in every case in which a kamatz is not a kamatz katan, the next letter has a horizontal line over it. And if the next letter doesn't have a horizontal line under it, which is almost never,
right,
in 5% of the cases, then the kamatz is a kamatz katan.
Because then that line becomes the accent, right? It's telling you that
the line,
not on the kamatz.
It's a little bit complicated. That line indicates that the next letter is the beginning of a new syllable, so that the previous syllable has been open, that it's ending with the vowel and not with the consonant.
Right, and the consonant have the accent and the kamatz.
Yeah.
We have to be careful, though, about saying Ashkenaz, about classifying Ashkenazic Hebrew as incorrect, because the stress is different.
I'm just saying. You didn't say that.
I know you didn't say that, but I'm just saying, because it was influenced by you.
Not a kamatz question, but an accent question, just that's been occurring to me. Is kavana or kavana?
Oh, that's...
According to the rules of grammar, it's kavana. The rules of grammar. According to the Ashkenazi tradition...
Kavana.
I got you.
Okay, back to what we're doing. which was now something fascinating. Fascinating, fascinating. Where in the back of the page we said, we're in the last of the three paragraphs I brought from Masechet Pesachim, Daf Chaf Aleph Amud Bet, at the top of the page, and it says, Mochol Enochri, quoting from the Mishnah, the Dibur Matril, and you can sell it to a non-Jew. Says the Gemara Pshita. That's simple. Because, again, if it's Mutar Bahanato, then all the more so is it certainly Mutar to Mochol Enochri. Is that right?
Yeah.
Right? Says the Gemara something fascinating. It says, La Puke Mihai De Mihai Tane De Tanya. To lapuke, to nullify, to undo, to prove wrong, from that Tana, that Tanit, from that rabbi that taught, Beit Shamayim Rim Lo Yimkor Adam Chemtso L'Nochri, Elim Ken Yodea Bo Shichle Kodem Pesach, Uveit Hillel Omrim Kol Shash Mutar Lechol Mutar Limkor. Translation of the Braita, Beit Shamayim says, one should not sell his chametz to a nochri, except if he knows concerning him that he will finish it, yichle, will finish it, kodem Pesach, before Pesach. O Beit Hillel Omrim, and Beit Hillel says, kol sha mutar lechol mutar limkor, every hour that it's allowed to eat, it's allowed to sell.
We had the same logic before about, I think, the wild animal. The wild animal could keep it around until after Pesach, said that was the chiddush. You may have thought that you couldn't.
Okay, to what okay, that's okay. Similar. Right, you're right. But here it's something even deeper.
Right.
It might be. Beit Hillel says that you're allowed to sell chametz as long as you're allowed to eat it, because that's hana'ah. Beit Shammai say that you can't sell it to the non-Jew if you know the non-Jew will have it on Pesach.
So what happened to the concept of an unconditional sale? Once I sell it, it's unconditional. That's that.
That's the point. Since it's an unconditional sale, by definition, that's what sale is, right? If you know that the non-Jew will have it on Pesach, you can't make the sale. Now the question is why? Mm-hmm. Why is that a problem?
That's a big problem. Is it some kind of hana'ah that the Jew is getting from it? That's one possibility, that I as a Jew am getting hana'ah.
I couldn't have made
because
that
I
sale
sold,
otherwise.
Yeah, because it's Erev Pesach, I sell it, the next day he's eating it, and
maybe
he's benefiting from...
Is it possible that under the legal system there, the buyer could have a right to return it for some reason?
No, if it's a sale, then it's a sale. There are other types of sales, but it says
maybe
limkor...
Maybe there's stringency, stringencies don't have a reasoning.
Right. There are two possibilities. Uh-huh. Either the reasoning of Beit Shammai is essential... In other words, that Beit Shammai in some sense feels that it's a sur d'oraita to make this sale, in which case the nochri would have the chametz on Pesach. And it's hard to figure out why that would be essentially forbidden, because he's not Jewish. Then another possibility is that it's what you call the stringency, it's a gzeira d'rabanan. And perhaps it's a gzeira because someone might see the chametz after Pesach, or even see it during Pesach, and know that that chametz used to belong to me, and think it still belongs to me, not know that we made a sale.
That's more probable, I would think.
More what?
That's what the Gemara. The Gemara says it's a isur derabanan. It's a gzeirah. It's not an essential prohibition. But let me just remind you of something. I want to remind everyone of something we might or might not have learned, perhaps not. A famous machloket Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai in the question of isurei Shabbat, melachan Shabbat.
Uh-huh.
It's called the prohibition of Shvitat Kelim, of your Kelim, of your vessels resting on Shabbat. And we all know that you're allowed to have electricity work for you on Shabbat. You can turn on electricity before Shabbat, and if it makes light on Shabbat, that's fine. Your washing machine is allowed to work on Shabbat if you turned it on before Shabbat. You can, all your appliances can work on Shabbat as long as you're not working them, as long as you did it before Shabbat. But Beit Shammai holds, no. Beit Shammai holds Shvitat Kelim. Your vessels have to rest just like you rest, and it's forbidden to do something before Shabbat so that your washing machine will work on Shabbat. It's forbidden to turn on lights before Shabbat so that they'll work on Shabbat. Not because of people working, but the machine itself can't be made to work by you on Shabbat, even though what you did is before Shabbat.
Kindling candles would be a problem as well, right? Kindling Shabbat candles because they're lit on Shabbat.
Oh, wow. I don't know. We don't hold like Beit Shammai. No. That's, I don't know.
So if we think of individuals as vessels, then we wouldn't have Ger do work on Shabbat. And then reflect,
it's all,
and it goes back to our Mishnah that we wouldn't want to have Gerim do things that are contrary to Halakha.
What are you saying, Gerim? How did Gerim get into it? You mean Nochrim?
Nochrim.
Yeah, Nochrim.
Yeah, that I mean, I'm just, you know.
But they're two different things, right? Nochri is a non-Jew, a Ger is a Jew.
Okay, so Nochrim. Yep. That you know, vessels, you know, in
right,
the one
that
you're relating,
there might be a relationship
on Shabbat, yes, and the relationship then is one of the reasons I'm finding is that it's that we don't want anyone to be contrary to the prohibition on Passover, regardless of their religion.
It makes sense, but we don't want to be too speculative, because there's lots of different legal details here. I don't want to give the wrong impression that there's no prohibition for non-Jews to eat chametz on Pesach.
Okay.
There isn't. Like, there's no prohibition for a non-Jew to have his washing machine work for him on Shabbat, even according to Beit Shammai.
Okay. Well, I was trying to create one, loosening the vessels.
Even for a non-Jew to press the button to turn it on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So with that, let us go back to the Mishnah. Let's go back to the Mishnah. And we now had reached question 6. Avar Zmano refers to the time for what? And that's clear. Avar Zmano, past the time for eating chametz. So and with the Mishnah. Is that it?
I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. So if the time for chametz eating passed, says the Mishnah, it's forbidden in benefit, hana'ah. And also says you can't fuel the tanur and the kirayim, the oven and the stove. So Mishnah 1, question 7. Of the two things that are forbidden, once avar zmano, which would seem to be the general category under which the other one should be subsumed?
I thought we did this.
No, we did this now for the ration. Now it's the seifa.
Okay.
Did it for the first part of the Mishnah. Now the second part. It says, "Avar zmano asur b'hana, lo yasik bo tenor v'chiraim."
So you have to say that.
First, say the question, then say the answer.
Okay. Question is, like the two things which are fueling candles or something.
Fueling the oven,
Or fueling the oven. So why?
And?
Or why does the Mishnah have to say that there's a more general category?
Right.
Yeah,
since it already said asur b'hana'ah, then I know that I can't fuel the oven with them.
Yeah, so the answer would be like benefiting, or the oven and the candles fall under the category of the benefit.
Right. And therefore, the Mishnah should not have written them, because it's obvious.
Yeah, we don't have the answer yet.
So then, can you think of a possible answer to the question, now that you have the question?
Well, I didn't even answer it.
Just the fact that you have the question is very good.
Yes.
Right.
Some of us didn't even know that.
But now we want to think, do we have a possible answer? Could there be any explanation why the Mishnah writes that you should not fuel the oven and the stove with chametz after the time of eating is finished?
Oh, you may think that you can't fuel it before and leave it fueled with it after the time passes. You may think that you wouldn't be allowed to fuel it before and allow it to be fueled even when the time passes without you fueling it. In other words, if you fueled it with chametz before the time.
The Gemara says something much easier.
Okay.
It relates to the next line of the Mishnah.
Okay.
Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Ein Bio Chametz Ela Srefa. There's no eradication of Chametz except through Srefa. So, which means that if you were to put the Chametz in the oven for fuel, at that same time you're filling the mitzvah of burning it. So So you might have thought to yourself that even though I'm not allowed to get hana'a, I am allowed to burn it. So I'll throw it in the oven to burn it, and I'll just happen to also warm myself through it. So here's the question. Can you get benefit from it while you're doing the mitzvah of burning it? And the Mishnah says, no, you can't.
Right. Uh-huh.
But you could have thought you could, because you're doing a mitzvah.
Huh.
Let's see that in the Gemara. So we turn to the back of the page. And the Gemara says, where is this? Didn't I bring this? I guess I didn't bring it.
I would have thought that this is a kashrut problem.
A kashrut problem.
With throwing chametz in the oven, even though it's being burned, because the way we hold today about kashering an oven, you know, the self-heating running for an hour.
It's a different oven. It has a place where there's fuel.
Yeah.
And you don't put food in there.
There's
a place above it where there's food.
Yeah, I know. But the way I would still think it was a problem, the way we hold today.
Okay, so you're kidding.
Wouldn't it? I mean,
but David's right.
Yeah, it's a different part of the oven. I know. But,
okay.
An hour should pass or something.
Okay. Let's now go on. I'm pushing hard. Yeah.
It burns.
But we start the first. It seems to me that the first part of the mission that we talked about and the second part leave just a huge number of more questions, because if we've said benefit does not necessarily include feeding or selling, right?
No. Well, I understand what you're saying.
Okay, so just as a summary statement.
You came to learn something.
So now in the second part we say benefit and don't burn. What about feeding to and selling?
If it says asur bahana'a, forbidden to get benefit, then it's forbidden to get benefit. I wouldn't have no reason to think that these other things might be allowed. It says you can't get benefit, so you can't. What comes out of the Mishnah is that as long as you can eat it, you can get benefit of all types. As long as you can't eat it, you can't get benefit.
The feeding and selling were different. Okay.
This tells you not to be obsessive, essentially. Not to be obsessive about getting benefit that it may be around after Pesach. From the non-Jew that you
see. You can't get benefit after the time that it's forbidden to eat.
Yeah.
That's all. That's all.
Okay.
Which, of course, just remember that halahala ma'ase, practical halakha, it means once it's forbidden to eat it on the morning of Pesach, which we hold is 4 hours, you can't sell it anymore.
Right.
Because it's not, well, I won't say why, but you can't sell it anymore.
But what Eric is correct. I mean, we learned that if you give it to your animals and they happen to not eat it, but leave some of it in their bin, and they're still eating it during the week, that's.
Oh, I see. Oh, I made a mistake.
He's saying it's
I didn't
not
say that's okay. Okay, I see.
No.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that.
Logic.
We said that as long as you're allowed to eat it, you're allowed to give it to your animals.
Right.
Even though it's true that your animals might leave some over. The point there wasn't that if they leave some over, it's okay to let them continue eating it later. No, the point is, even though it's going to make you come back and pick it up and get rid of it, you're still allowed to put yourself into that difficult situation.
Except for the wild animal, you wouldn't be concerned necessarily about the wild animal bringing it onto your property, because we said about the chuldah. Would that apply about the chuldah?
So with the wild animals, the truth is, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
But if you have reason to believe that there's chametz on your property,
you have to
find it and get rid of it.
And burn it in a way that you're not getting benefit.
Exactly. In other words, if you find chametz after the fourth hour on Erev Pesach, you have to get rid of it, but you can't get benefit from it, as we just saw. Which means that you have to burn it in a fashion that you don't get benefit from, or flush it down the toilet, or do one of the other things we're about to read.
Once that time passes, and it's Erev Pesach after the 6th hour, the 7th hour, the 8th hour, and you see chametz is on your property that the wild animal brought on, then it's hefker. Then you're not concerned about it, right?
Why?
Because you have to burn it by the 6th hour, so...
No, not correct. If you find chametz on your property after the time of eating it has passed, you have to fulfill the mitzvah of teshbitu, and you have to make sure that you are not transgressing bal yira'eh or bal yimatzeh, which means burn it, or flush it down the toilet, or throw it to the wind. And if it's already chag, when you're not allowed to burn it, you still have to get rid of it immediately.
We're taking the bitul off the table.
Right. There's those who say that you can be mivatelet. You can just say to yourself, it's not mine anymore.
Right.
But if you're able to get rid of it, then you get rid of it. Flush it down the toilet during the Seder.
I mean, there's a little bit of tension that I think between that Mishnah that says you have to burn it by the sixth hour. You burn it, it's burnt.
Okay.
You fulfilled the mitzvah of burning it. The eighth hour, a wild animal brings it onto your property. Didn't you fulfill the mitzvah of burning it?
I'm not... What do you mean?
If a plummet comes onto your property.
I'm saying,
but you said the Mishnah. What Mishnah is talking about it?
Oh, the Mishnah before where we said that you have to burn it by the Rabbi Huda and Rabbi Meir, or was it Rabbi Huda and the Chachamim about burning it by the sixth hour?
Agree you have to burn it by the sixth hour.
So I'm saying if a wild animal would bring chametz on your property the eighth hour, the ninth hour, the tenth hour.
Mm-hmm.
I would think from this that I wouldn't have. I already burnt it. The time for burning it passed. I burned it, and now what's the status of that chametz?
It's not yours because it's not in your.
Putting bitul.
Right, so I don't know. I think we didn't have to nullify it. It was never yours, and it's not yours. But
it's
the
rat.
But I'm not sure.
It falls under the rat.
Because I thought
you can
the rat.
Make the problem simpler, and that is you missed some in your house. Who missed this in the drawer? There's a loaf of bread here.
It's clear. It's your problem because it's yours.
That's what I'm
saying.
Right.
Okay, that
it's
I understand.
Problem.
Okay. That's a clear example.
Yeah.
So there you're saying you would have to burn it even though the sixth hour passed and you already burned it, you would burn it.
Okay.
Say something?
Yeah.
There was a misunderstanding here.
Yeah.
When we learn that you don't have to fear that if a rat brings chametz onto your property,
that means you don't have to look again.
Right.
It doesn't mean you don't have to find it.
If you find it, you certainly have to get rid of it.
Right.
But you don't have to.
Yeah,
put
I understand. Back. I understand the distinction. Okay.
You don't have to look for it. You don't have to go out with a magnifying glass.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. Now we get to question 9. Which opinion brought in the previous chapter might our Mishnah come to oppose? And the previous chapter, I'm going to tell you the answer.
Please.
That we're talking about Mishnah Dalet, the Machloket Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda, which was just mentioned. Mishnah Dalet, page 144 in the printing of Hanoch Halbeck. Middle of page 144, Mishnah Dalet, Rabbi Meir Omer. Ochlin kol chamesh besorfin d'tchilat shesh. We eat it until the end of the fifth hour, and we burn it by the beginning of the sixth hour. Rabbi Yehuda omer ochlin kol arba. Rabbi Yehuda says you can only eat it to the end of the fourth hour. V'tolin kol chamesh, and we hang it the fifth hour. In other words, the fifth hour, it's in limbo. You can't eat it, but you don't have to have it burnt yet. V'sorfin b'tchilat shesh, and we burn the beginning of the sixth hour. Now the Gemara says that our Mishnah we learned today contradicts one of these two opinions. Which do you think it is?
That you hold it.
Oh, I think it's the limbo.
You're right.
Yeah.
Right. The limbo. Right. Because the limbo implies, it doesn't say explicitly, implies
there's no man's land.
That if you don't, if you're not allowed to eat it after the fourth hour, and the fifth day you can't eat it, but you're allowed to have it, that implies having it, implies doing something with it, which implies hana'ah. So the Gemara says that Rabbi Yehuda holds that on the fourth hour, you have to have it burnt by the end of that. The fifth hour, you can't eat it, but you can get hana'ah. Whereas at the beginning of the sixth hour, you have to burn it. And you can't even get hana'ah once you burn it. But our Mishnah says that there is no hana'ah allowed after the time of eating has passed. So the Gemara says that our Mishnah seems to nullify, to cancel, to contradict Rabbi Yehuda. That's what the Gemara says. You can debate that, but that's It makes a certain degree of sense.
There's no attempt to resolve it?
The halakha really, the Gemara says that halakha is not like Rabbi Yehuda.
Oh, okay.
It's like a third opinion doesn't even appear in the Mishnah.
Oh, right, okay.
Okay, question 10 we did. What Torah mitzvah does the biur fulfill? We said it's tashbitu. And now look at question 11. This is interesting. In what two different ways might one understand the exact practices that the Hachamim are setting forth? So we have to go to the Hachamim in the end of our Mishnah Aleph. And the Mishnah had said, v'hachamim omrim, the last eight words of the Mishnah, hachamim omrim, af mefarer v'zore l'ruach o matir l'yam, even crumble and throw to the wind, or place in the sea. Grammatically, I should say syntactically, there are two different ways to read what the Hachamim said. Think of this a minute. Think of it syntactically. Okay, Sam?
You could, like, something that you didn't say. Like, an alternative reading than what you read. An alternative translation would be, you can either crumble it, or you can place it in the wind or the sea. Is that right? You can crumble it, or you can place it in the wind or the sea. Is that different?
As opposed to?
Crumbling it to the wind, placing it in the sea.
No. I think if this is a minimalist.
You almost said it. You almost said it.
Or placing it in
other words, you can, even if you, this is the, you would, this is the minimum that you can, it's like a minimalist.
No, you have to do, you can read it by saying, you have to, in combination, crumble it and throw it to the wind, or crumble it and put it in the sea.
Right.
That's what you're required to do, both things.
Right.
Oh, I have a
or you can read it as saying, you can crumble it. That's a good way thing to do.
Right.
Or you can throw it in the sea.
No. Where?
No.
That doesn't work syntactically. But.
Or you have to crumble it and throw it in the wind.
Or
you can throw it in the sea.
Right. And the other way of reading it is.
Crumble it and throw it in this. Throw it to the wind, or crumble it and throw it in the sea.
Right. Right.
If you throw it in the sea, you don't have to crumble it.
That's the question.
Okay. Do you have to crumble it? Is it enough if you just throw it in the sea without crumbling it?
Right.
It's a separate deal.
Right. The word mifarer, crumble, is that part of the expression Zoreh L'ruach, or is it a introduction that is meant to cover both Zoreh L'ruach and Matir L'yam?
I can think of another alternative, which is if you have chametz that's crumbleable, and you have chametz that's uncrumbleable. So if you have chametz that's crumbleable, you crumble it and you throw it in the wind.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you throw it in the sea.
Throw it in the sea.
Okay.
It's inedible.
That makes sense.
But it depends on the question. Does the word mifarer, crumble, does it apply also to matir l'yam? If it does, then in your case, you'd have to get a sledgehammer and crumble it.
I would think once it's in the sea, it's inedible.
Say it again?
Yeah, it's inedible. You're trying to make it inedible. When you make it into crumbs, it's inedible, and you throw
water
it into
the sea.
Well, not inedible to fish, but to make it in such a fashion that human beings
wouldn't need it.
Right, so that's the question. That's the question. And you'll see the Gemara discusses that question on the back of the sheet. And the Gemara says, that we're going to skip, right here. Masechet Pesachim Daf Kaf Chet Amud Aleph. The Hachamim Omrim Mefarer V'Zoreh V'Chulei. The Hachamim say, crumble and throw, etc. Ibayalahu. It was asked of them. Heichi Kamar. How does it say? Mefarer V'Zoreh L'Ruach Mefarer Matir L'Yam. Crumble and throw to the wind, or crumble and put in the sea. O Dilma, or perhaps Mifarer v'Zoreh L'Ruach aval Matir L'Yam, crumble and throw to the Ruach, but put in the sea without the crumbling. That's the question, and the Gemara ends up saying, I'm sorry, and the last word is Be'ine, as it is. In other words, are you allowed to throw into the sea as it is? Be'ine, as it is, without crumbling. That's the question. The Gemara doesn't come to a conclusion. The Gemara doesn't come to a conclusion.
Because they're not living near the sea, they're living in Babel.
Yeah, there's rivers there, though.
Yeah.
Well, the logic person would say, you know, like, part of software engineering is all about taking phrases exactly like this and making definitive statements out of them. And it's unfortunately, with that background, terribly clear to me in that it's, where was it? It's two steps for the first one, for wherever Zoret. And the second one is Matilayim.
But how do you know that?
Again, that bias tells me it's two steps or one step.
You have to. What you would have to do linguistically is do a corpus. Corpus linguistics is called. You'd have to see what is if the verb is used in the context and how it's applied.
Yeah, but since the Mishnah is a text redacted from earlier separate texts,
right,
it's not always consistent in its linguistic usages. Mm-hmm. So that is not a foolproof method.
You'd have to take the early texts and apply corpus
text of the same type, and it's impossible to know which are texts from the same type of the same Beit Midrash.
You don't need to know.
Well, let us, we're going to end pretty soon. Let's look at my last question on this Mishnah, and then perhaps we'll do the other two Mishnah that I planned, but very, very quickly. The last question says, what might be the conceptual disagreement between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim? In other words, when Rabbi Yehuda says that the mitzvah tashbitu of bi'ur is only through sreifa, and I'm assuming that that means that it really becomes burnt completely charcoal, and the Chachamim say the mitzvah tashbitu even includes throwing it into the wind after you crumble it up, or place it in the sea. So what is the machloket?
Whether a non-Jew or animal can benefit.
Whether a non-Jew or animal can benefit. I think that you're right, but that's not stating, I think, it's not stating the concept, it's rather ramification of the concept.
Oh, it's existence versus non-existence?
Right.
Existence,
Let's define what it means to lashbit et hachametz. What does it mean? So according to the Achamim, it means that it won't exist anymore. That's what it means.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Rabbi Yehuda.
Right, Rabbi
Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda doesn't exist anymore. It's gone. It doesn't exist in the world. Sreifa, burning. According to the Achamim, if you mifareh l'ruach, if you crumble and place in the wind, it's still there. It exists, just like it did before. It's in a different form, and human beings wouldn't use it, and it's certainly not yours anymore, but it's still there. I think the question is, what's the definition of tashbitu? To make it stop existing? Or to remove it from human usage? I think. Okay, let's just read the last two Mishnayot that I want to look at, because I want to end within, certainly within 10 minutes, perhaps within 5 minutes. Says the Mishnah, the next Mishnah, it says, Chametz shelenochri shavar lav pesach mutar bahana'a v'shel Yisrael asur bahana'a sh'ne'emar v'lo yir'eh lecha se'or. Translation, the chametz of a nochri that passed on it the Pesach is permitted in hana'a, and of Yisrael is forbidden bahana'a. As the verse says, will not be seen to chametz. So let's just look at the principle here that we're talking about chametz shavar alav Pesach, chametz that existed during Pesach. If the Pesach passed over it, now it's after Pesach, what do I do? So the halakha is that if a non-Jew owned it on Pesach, then after Pesach, there's no prohibition at all. You can buy it from him. He can give it to you. You can eat his house if it's possible with Pashut strictures to do such a thing. In other words,
during
the Chametz is... After Pesach, there's nothing wrong with it.
Right.
But if a Jew owned it on Pesach, then after Pesach it's Asur Bahana'a. That's a Gzeirah de Rabbanan.
Mm-hmm.
That it's Asur Bahana'a if a Jew owned it. If you owned it or if a different Jew owned it. Which means that if you, and this happens in Israel, if you go to your local makolet, your local grocery store, and it was open on Pesach, and the owner had chametz there, then after Pesach you can't buy from him chametz until the chametz that's in the store, you know, has been sold, that chametz that exists during Pesach, and he got a new shipment. But what happens if the company is owned by Jews?
and usual, thankfully.
And they didn't get rid of their chametz on Pesach. So you couldn't buy from the company until their whole stock that they had in stock during Pesach is gone. It might take a whole year. So like Eric said, in America, it's one advantage of living at Galut that the stores are not owned by Jews in most cases. Right. In Brooklyn it might be different. But in theory, if you know of any company that is owned by Jews or any store owned by Jews, then you couldn't buy chametz there after Pesach unless you were certain that it's chametz that was made chametz after Pesach. In Israel we have Tudot, certificates that the store gets that says I didn't own chametz during Pesach. I sold it or something else, and then you can buy chametz from them because you know all the chametz they have is fresh. Not chametz shavar alav Pesach. And I guess we will end there.
It's usually not a problem in Israel, by the way. Right? I mean.